This is the backup episode. Yes, we are going to talk all about backing up, how to do it, when to do it, what software to use for it, and we'll probably have time for a cool Mac app or a hack here or there. Gort, are you there?
I am here.
Fantastic. We are recording today from the Astiopod studio, or at least I am. So yeah, we're going to talk about backing up because we've been talking about doing an episode about it for a little while now. And I guess it almost goes up without saying that backing up is important these days. I mean, we have so much on our computers now that if you're not backing up, I mean...
Oh, it's a sad thing to see a grown man cry.
Right.
And I just pushed the one button, and now I can't find, and you know, fill in the blank, whatever person's document was. But more importantly, it's like pictures. Oh, right. Man. I mean, you know, pictures are important to people.
Yeah, they have been for 100 years now. You know, we like our photographs. We like our Kodak memories.
And then on a practical side, the stuff that, I mean, pictures can make money for people if you're a professional photographer, or even a freelance, but then you've got the documentation that goes with it. You got your financial files, you got your email and your love letters, and backup is indeed important. There are so many things on the computer that are near and dear to our hearts, our special pictures, and then there's all sorts of files we work on for work and maybe for school. And it represents a great deal of time and effort and creative energy. It's all important stuff.
Saving and accidentally deleting things and things like that, I mean, that's bad enough. But if your hard drive goes out on you, that's a huge, I mean, that's loss of data on just a monumental scale. And, you know, I mean, there's always, like, I think in the back of a lot of people's minds, there's kind of like, well, should that ever happen, I'll just bite the bullet and I'll pay whatever it takes to get some hard drive recovery place to get all my data off. And no one really knows how much that really is. And I really maintain that that's just a racket out there, you know, because these places will charge you a lot of money without any kind of guarantee of actually getting your data off of the drive.
And I've been there and done that, and I think that the prices are based on the level of quiver in your voice.
Yes, exactly. I've also inquired to those places, and I've even been on the other end. I've people know that I'm fairly computer savvy, and they will come to me with hard drives that have, you know, are for whatever reason not working the way they think it should work. Now, luckily, I'm not making a living doing that kind of thing. These are just my friends, so I'll take it and I'll look at it and do what I can. And a lot of times, luckily, it's been just really minor software issues that I've been able to repair for them. But yeah, a lost hard drive, you know, if you think that you can just go to some place and just and you think of it, well, that'll just be my insurance cost. You know, it's just I'll just pay that amount. You're in for a surprise when you hear the amount, and you're in for a surprise when you hear that there's not really any way for them to say, don't worry, you pay us this money and you'll get your data back. It's more like, pay the money, we'll see what we can do, and, you know, you just
have
to take your chances.
The better insurance, I guarantee you, is $50 or $100 for a software program or some sort of subscription.
Yeah.
And one of the best subscriptions I know, and I use, and I have used to recover files, is .Mac Backup.
Absolutely. I've used it. I use it a lot myself.
And I use it right out of the box, as it were. It doesn't come in a box. It comes with your .Mac subscription. You just download it and install in your typical Mac ease of operation.
Well, actually, you know, that's one thing, though, that does cause a little bit of confusion, because when you buy the .Mac, you know, they've got the backup program right there on the box or on the web page. They don't really necessarily tell you where to go get that, and what you have to do is you sign into your iDisk, and you go into the software folder that's there, and you just download the backup program, and there's two there. There's one for Jaguar and Panther, and then there's one for Tiger, so... Get whichever one you need, grab it off your iDisk, and drag it over to your applications.
Very good, very good. Good It's specifics.
Yes.
That's right.
And I like the .Mac one because it's really, really, it's very Mac-like. You know, it's part of iLife practically. You know, it's that integrated. It just kind of, it comes naturally, I think. Once you set it up, then it just kind of happens on its own, depending on how you have it set up.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The ease of use and how it looks on the screen is all very Mac intuitive, as it were.
Yeah.
One thing we need to talk about is how often should you back up?
Oh, right. Sure, yeah.
That's part of the scheduling thing that you do in backup, and it's kind of up to the user, and user dependent, of course. I don't change my music files very often. I don't download a lot of music. I pretty much got what I want, and that's it. Or I buy CDs, and I don't necessarily do a lot of rip, mix, and burn. So, you know, my little iTunes list is, you know, 100 or so songs that I managed to download, and, you know, it's just okay. So, like I say, it doesn't change very much. If I use .Mac to back that up, I wouldn't need to schedule a backup on that any more than probably once every 2 weeks.
Sure.
My pictures, on the other hand, I might change pictures every week. I go out on weekends and I take some pictures of friends and family and so forth. And then I download on a Sunday evening before I go back to the real job on Monday. And that could change weekly. So I'd want my backup scheduled by week. Addresses, names and addresses in my address book. I've got, you know, 10 or so names in there. I don't have very many friends.
Right.
And if I get a new one, I might put it in there. So they might change every month. So you can set up your backup to back up any element within the iLife suite or any other part of your hard drive as frequently or as infrequently as you'd like. You can build that by yourself, or you can take the canned ones that are in backup that are already there.
Yeah, see, my custom has been so far just to kind of build it myself, but I don't break mine down like you do. That's kind of cool that you do, like, your music separately from your photos and that separately from your address book. That's neat.
Just one of the many, many options that you have when you get the full load of backup. It is very user-friendly and very adaptable. Make it your own.
What do you back up to, typically?
Well, I use a combination of the data space that's allowed on my .Mac account. I have all my preferences backed up to there.
Okay.
So that's one easy spot to get it. If and when I get my new laptop, I will just simply download some of those preferences right off of my .Mac backup files.
Right.
The other thing is I have a really cheap USB. And so, well, man, if you're going to back up, why are you using such a cheap hard drive?
Right.
Well, two reasons. Hard drives are cheap.
They really are now.
You can get them for about $120 and 120 gigabytes. I mean, they're just really reasonable.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's less than that. I mean, it was $1 a gig, I think, earlier this year, and now, like, depending on how much you're getting, it can be less than $1 a gig, which is just great.
So did I mention that you should have your external hard drive twice the size of whatever you're running in your machine?
No.
Well, that's a good place to start. You can have them bigger, of course, but the starting place, rule of thumb, make sure your external hard drive is twice as large as that which is in your machine that you want to back up. So the first time you back up, it's going to be the longest.
Right.
So
right.
Do this when you've got lots of time on your hands, or you're going to put it on autopilot and go out for dinner, because this thing is going to take a long time. Start at the evening news and don't worry about it until breakfast.
Right.
What it does is make a complete file on that external hard drive of whatever's on your machine drive now. And the next time it does a backup, it goes to the baseline picture of your drive on the external drive, makes it and does the comparison. Whatever's changed is going to save based on the schedule you have established for the files that you have established.
Right.
Now, the beauty of this is it keeps track of all the stuff for you. You don't have to. You set up the schedule, you set up the files, whichever ones you want backed up, and it does the rest. I have had great success with .Mac backup. I've even had the opportunity to do a restore selectively, and it works like a charm.
Really? Yeah, I haven't done that yet. So what? How was it? Like, is it easy? How do you find what you need?
Well, in this particular case, it was an address problem. I had changed an address incorrectly, and it didn't get to the backup yet. And I discovered the error a couple of days later, and said, "Oh man, I've deleted some stuff and I put in some stuff, and now I'm all confused. I don't know where I am on this."
Right.
So, you know, the ideal situation is simply go back to, you know, turn the clock back. I want to go back in time to where I was when I knew what I had. So that day was, let's say, a Monday. I said, okay, and today is a Friday. I simply go back to Monday's copy and say restore.
I see.
And I don't have the screens up in front of me, but it is as simple as starting the backup program. Select the fact you want to restore. That's a selection within the file area. And then it presents you with, okay, these are the things that you've backed up. Where from what would you like to draw your restore?
Wow, that's phenomenal.
It lists your files. You pick a day. You pick a file name, address book on Monday, the proper date. Double click, and you got it.
That's very nice.
And it's that simple. I mean, I just talked through it. Like I say, I don't have it in front of me at the moment, but it is that easy.
So that is, in a way, I mean, that's kind of like, you know, the much-hyped Time Machine in Leopard. That's kind of Time Machine, just without the fancy animation.
Ah, could be. And I've read about that. And that is very clever if they've done it that way.
Yeah, I mean, they've given basically every file, I guess, its own little icon or something. You can go in and whoosh around within your backup file and really kind of just choose what you want to backup. I mean, restore. But it sounds like you can pretty much do the same thing just without the fancy swooshing and the whooshing around. Just grab whatever you need and restore it.
Yes, true enough. And the reason I don't have the backup in front of me right now is because it really likes to have the external drive present.
Oh, sure.
Otherwise, it begs you to have it.
It
bothers you to have it.
So you don't have. So this is not a drive that you have, obviously, plugged in all the time. This is something that you plug in and turn on only when you know that a backup is going to occur.
Yes, because I don't want anything to happen to this data.
Right.
I want it to be that secure. So while it is on my desktop, physically, right there, on my desk, it is not turned on and it's not plugged in until it nears the time for backup, which is usually late at night and before I retire.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize that the drive that they're going to back up to, one of the things that makes it such a great backup, even if it's like that cheap USB drive, is only on for a couple of hours a week or whatever your backup scheme is. Even if it's just a couple of hours a night, that's a lot less than a drive that is being accessed constantly while you're editing a photo or editing a video or whatever.
Right, and therefore the reliability is probably on par for as many hours as it's turned on.
Exactly, yeah. And, I mean, worst backup experiences, people coming to me, all, you know, very proud of themselves. Hey, Klaatu, you know, look at this. I'm backing up. They'll bring out this drive, and I'll ask them, well, if you're backing up to this drive, why do you have it on you? What are you doing? And they'll say, oh, well, this is where I have some of those pictures I wanted to show you, and the video too, and all my music is on here, you know. And it's like, so this is your backup drive, and it's the drive that you carry around with you to access all of your personal data. It's just like, I mean, that's kind of.
That's just an external drive, folks.
That's not a backup drive. That's a working drive. So, not a good idea to really use your backup drive. Get your cheap USB, because it doesn't have to be fast. I mean, this is something backup typically, traditionally, is something that happens in the wee hours of the night. No one's on the network or no one's on your computer. And it's just backing up, and it can be as slow as it wants to be.
And so that combination of the external, inexpensive or reasonably priced backup drive, the way to go for all of your backup needs.
Yeah. One thing that's becoming kind of fashionable right now, and I have an idea that Leopard is going to kind of almost not rely on this, but really kind of exploit this to its fullest, is the idea of having like a network attached storage where you can, especially with the new Airport Extreme, the one that does not look like the UFO, it's the little slim one that kind of looks like an Apple TV or a Mac Mini. It's like really small.
Oh, yeah.
That has a data port on it. Like, it's just a USB port, but it's a USB 2.0, so it's fast enough to actually handle basically a hard drive. So the idea is that you can plug in your very large USB hard drive into your airport base station and have that as basically your backup drive, that all your computers in your house that are on the network, you know, every night when they go to back up, they're sending the information over the network into that hard drive. And so it's a localized drive, doesn't ever move, doesn't ever get accessed except to back up to it.
Oh, very clever.
Yeah, and from what I understand, I mean, obviously no one really knows this yet, but from what I understand, the whole time machine feature will be able to back up, and I think probably it'll probably be like a choice that they kind of promote to, you know, a network-attached storage for those households that really have, like, an elaborate, you know, sort of local area network with lots of computers, computer in the kids' room and in the family room and in the parents' room, you know, all that stuff.
You know, that's something I think we need to go to for a future segment on Bad Apples, is to look at the future of the home network as both a communication and education and entertainment tool.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, Apple TV obviously is making huge inroads into really exploiting your local area home network. Because, I mean, a lot of people that I know are literally, they rip DVDs that they've bought from the store, not to redistribute or to pirate or anything like that, but they'll rip it onto their computer so that they can access it, you know, no matter where they are. And if they're on their computer, they can watch it. And if they're sitting in their living room at their TV with their Apple TV hooked up to it, they have access to their entire media library, you know, right there, just wirelessly via their network.
Well, we got a little far afield here. I didn't mean to hijack the conversation over to entertainment, but
fair enough. It's a hard subject for me to avoid. But
being in the arena and all.
Exactly. But yeah, I mean, so backing up, how far do your backups go anyway? Like, do you have, like, I don't know, a month's worth of stuff you could call from, or 6 days, or what? Give me an idea of what you've got.
Well, now let's see. Enterprise folks would talk about months and years of archives, and in fact, my installation boasts 6 months.
Wow.
But around the house here, I go back about a month. Hopefully by then I've figured out which pictures I want to keep and which pictures I've put in the bit bucket.
Right.
And then at some time I have to sit down and kind of resort those photos, strip all that stuff off to CDs, and then pack them away. Otherwise my hard drive will be full.
Right. So you have like an archive of hard disks, or I should say optical media, I guess, for things that are very old, and then you have your recent stuff on your actual USB drive.
Right. Now, the USB drive that I use for backup, that's only backup, and one thing that I, the real-life experience, here I am running backup on my 120 gig USB. All is going well. It's doing all its automatic things the way it should, and life is good, until one day I get the little red light on the backup that says drive is full, insert new drive.
Wow.
So abort the backup and let me see what I've done here, and sure enough, I just filled up the USB drive.
Oh, with everything you've ever backed up.
With all the backups, and I'm thinking, well, I guess I forgot about that.
Yeah.
There's got to be the rolling nature of your backups. So if this were an enterprise situation, I would have physical tapes in my hand, large data tapes. They look like big cassette tapes. And I'd say, okay, how many of these tapes am I going to keep in the refrigerator storage room? I say it's refrigerator. It's air conditioned and
probably off-site.
Oh yeah, off-site.
Because I mean, if your main place goes up in flames or something, obviously, you don't want your archives there.
Correct. And these things are stored with, you know, a big plan, and they're going to be rotated out. And obviously, our plan at my place is 6 months.
Yeah.
Every 6 months, the oldest one falls into the grinder, because it's proprietary data. It's got to be destroyed.
Okay.
And it gets ground to to dust and then recycled.
Now the CIA could probably still reassemble that, right?
Maybe with a molecular reassembler.
Right.
So then a new one comes in the door, and all is well with the world. So if you pictured it, if this was in your house on a bookshelf, and you only had room for 15 of these tapes, you'd put 1 through 15, and then the next time you put another one on there, the other one at the other end is going to fall off in their trash can.
Right,
so that's the same way you have to do on your external USB hard drive. You have to figure out how much space you're going to need as a buffer, and so you have a virtual shelf on your hard drive there, and you put one in, you physically, the user, have to go in and delete the old one.
Gotcha, and that's why you were saying twice the size of your real hard drive for your backup.
Yeah, because you're going to need a little wiggle room in there to do some maneuvering.
Sure.
And there's some more features inside of backup that help you do this.
Cool. Well, I know that I know that big enterprise business kind of settings, I'm sure they have their own probably proprietary backup solution. But I know that it seems like the de facto backup program out there that you always kind of hear about, aside from .Mac, is Retrospect.
Well, that's because it comes packaged with just about every new hard drive you buy. At least it did for quite some time. I've got a couple of old SCSI drives here and three or four different versions of Retrospect CD install CDs for Retrospect laying around. It's kind of a Retrospect light, as it were. You can buy the complete version. In fact, they encourage you to do so after you've got your hard drive up and running.
Well, they encourage you by not giving you any software updates for that light version. You know, I mean, it's you're coasting along thinking you're doing fine with Retrospect, and you update your system software, and at some point you go back to Retrospect, and all of a sudden nothing works, and you wonder why.
Uh-huh.
At least that was my experience. Now, if they've fixed that, okay, they fixed it. But the last time I used it, I was shocked to find that my backup files just weren't read by Retrospect, and the reason was, I later found out, that because, you know, I'd upgraded to, you know, 10.4.6 or whatever, and Retrospect just wasn't going to release an update for their little light version.
Unless you bought the whole package.
Right.
Uh-huh. Well, I tell you, I guess I just never kept any of those other drives long enough to worry about it, because on the vast majority of backups that I do on any other system in the house that is being used for educational purposes or lab work, the files are simply stripped off onto a CD, and that becomes the archive, and that keeps the working files on the local drive at a reasonable count.
Right.
So I just haven't had the need to use Retrospect beyond setup and a couple of routine, mundane uses along the way before it just didn't matter anymore. So I can't say too much about Retrospect other than the fact that when I did use it, I wasn't drawn to it. It didn't do anything that I couldn't have done with a careful, thought-out plan of backup and a bunch of CDs.
Yeah, and the setup, in my experience, the setup wasn't half as easy as .Mac backup. It was a situation where you almost had to learn how to set it up on your first pass and then kind of erase everything that you did and set it up again once you know how to do it. It wasn't like .Mac where you just, you know, you click on it, you say, yeah, that's the plan I want, or you click the plus sign to make your own plan, and it's all kind of easy. You just drag and drop the folders that you want to do within that certain time, and you schedule it, and if you want to do another one, you just drag and drop and do it again. You know, it's pretty simple. But with Retrospect, you have to, you know, save these sort of preference files that they'll call your backup plan, and you have to name them something, and then you have to define what it is that you're backing up. And yeah, it's pretty complex, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, that's probably why I defaulted to CDs and paper and pencil.
Yeah, I guess the disadvantage with Retrospect being, aside from the setup, being the fact that the light and the limited versions that you normally get with your hard drive, you know, they expire. I guess if you bought a copy, it would probably be a pretty good solution. And with .Mac, after a while, if you don't keep your .Mac account current, your backup actually doesn't work anymore.
I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either until I let my .Mac account expire at one point. I forget. I guess I just wanted to see. I don't think it was all really intentional, but I decided to go and back up and see if it. Or maybe it was. No, I think if you just turn off your .Mac, like if you actually took it off your computer, like put in a different .Mac account or fake information in the system preferences so your computer no longer realizes that it's, you know, attached to that .Mac, and go to run your backup, if I recall correctly, it will not be able to access, you know, your information, and it will just say, well, you can use this for up to, I think, 100 megabytes as a trial, but for full access, you have to renew your account or you know, open a .Mac account. And it kind of surprised me and disappointed me because I thought, you know, part of the thing was when they sold me the .Mac, part of the thing that they were really excited about was the backup feature, and I was excited about the backup feature, and they kind of sold it as if though it was for, you know, forever. You know, you buy .Mac and then, you know, you'll always have your backup program. But it's not quite true. They actually disable it if you're not paying your money.
Wow, you know, I wouldn't have thought of that because I would have thought that I could understand the portion of backup not working with the features that go out to the iDisk.
Right.
That would be understandable. If you don't have a .Mac account, well, then you can't get to iDisk.
Right.
But it doesn't seem fair that that they wouldn't allow you to continue to use the program to back up to your external hard drive.
That's kind of what I thought at first, and then I kind of thought about it, because even with retrospect, you know, you buy it 1 year, and maybe it'll last you, and it's a lot more than .Mac, and you're not getting all that you get with .Mac, like your email and your iDisk and your website and stuff like that. So you buy Retrospect, and you use it, and you're probably not happy with it, because I don't really love the program, but it would be better than nothing, obviously. So let's assume that you've bought it to be a good backup person. You're using it, but then at some point you figure they're going to stop updating that version, and you're going to have to buy a new copy to get, like, the new features for, you know, whatever hot new operating system you're running. So it's just kind of like, I mean, when you're buying proprietary software, you don't use it forever. You at some point you update for yourself, and you pay it again. And so with .Mac, you're just paying $100 again, and you're keeping your backup solution current, plus you're getting your email and your iDisk and everything else that comes with .Mac.
Well, yes. It's a worthy service.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And it makes, I mean, again, I think it's the easiest backup solution out there, really, at least in terms of it just being something that you set up once and you almost forget about, and it just kind of keeps going for you.
Well, true enough.
Yeah, but, I mean, even so, what I was doing, I kind of, you know, I was a little bit disturbed by the .Mac conking out on me if you're not, or the backup, rather, if you're not current with your .Mac. And like I say, I'm not terribly fond of Retrospect just because it's not terribly easy to understand. And I kind of lost confidence in it as well. Although now that I'm talking it out, it's probably not fair because if I bought the full version, I'd probably be able to use it, you know, very, very, very well. But what I did was I started exploring other options. And obviously there are always shareware and freeware versions of backing up out there. And I did try a couple of little software titles, you know, that I would find on Version Tracker or SourceForge. And they would work, you know, they would do what you needed them to do. But you never really know with those either how long those projects are going to be kept up and supported. So the one that I finally fell into was, of course, in the terminal.
Oh, what a surprise.
Rsync, which is spelled Rsync, is just a little terminal command. And its only function is to synchronize and back up your local information on your hard drive with whatever drive you point it toward. And that's the great thing about Unix programs. All these little terminal things, they're just little tiny software programs, and they just have such a focused purpose in life that they're just kind of almost easy in spite of themselves. And the cool thing about Rsync is that you know, it's not, you don't have to do it to another hard drive. You can also do it over your network. So if you're doing the whole Airport Express network attached storage thing, you can use Rsync with that as well. It's a very, very robust little program. And of course, as always, if you ever aren't sure how to use one of these terminal programs, it's only one terminal command away. It's just man, M-A-N, as in manual, space, rsync, or whatever you're trying to learn about. So if you want to read the whole manual about rsync, it's M-A-N, space, rsync. And you'll find pages and pages of information on it with all the different options that you can use along with it. Of course, not all the manuals are written well. I think I was pretty happy with the rsync one, though.
Well, you get quite a bit of information just by going to the terminal, typing in sudo space rsync, you're prompted for your password, and then you come up with the rsync version 2.6.3 protocol version 28, the URL for Samba, and then all of the things that you can do with rsync concerning its usage and options. And scrolling down here, then we see, please see the rsync and the rsynced, that would be rsynced dot conf man pages for the full documentation along with the URL and so forth. So it's pretty complete just by typing in the sudo rsync, and it gives you a wealth of information for the quick start user.
And rsync is actually really easy to use. If you just type in rsync space dash av and then space slash users slash, you know, my user folder space slash volumes slash backup drive. So you're basically just defining it that you're going to run rsync, and you're going to run it in the verbose mode so that it actually gives you feedback on what has been backed up. That's a very nice option. And then you just tell it what folder you want to back up. So that would be the slash users slash my user folder. Or if there's something within your user folder that you want to back up, you know, you could say slash users slash my user folder slash music. And then the space means that now you're going to give it the destination. And that's the slash volumes slash backup drive. Because anytime in Mac OS X where you're going out to another drive, you have to go back to the volumes folder.
Very good. Okay.
And it the first time that you run it, obviously, since it's synchronizing, it'll take a long time because it's going to copy everything that you've defined as the source. It's going to copy it all to your destination.
It's got to have a baseline, a place to start.
Yeah. It does it really well, and you can set up as many different rsync schemes as you want, and you don't have to, like, you can use the rsync.conf, which is just a text file basically that your system is going to look toward whenever you invoke rsync, and you can put in the different folders that you want to be backed up. Now, to schedule it to do it automatically, because obviously it's all fine to be terminal cool and just type in rsync whenever you want to, but I mean, realistically, you're not going to do that. I mean, we're human, right? We need it to be automated for us, or we're going to forget. We're going to say, well, I don't feel like doing it tonight. I'll just do it another time. So the way that you automate something in Unix and obviously in the Mac, in the terminal, is with a little program called cron, C-R-O-N. And that's almost as easy as rsync. You just you open up the terminal, you type in crontab, that's crontab, space dash e, and that brings up the it's basically a cron configuration file for you as the user, and you enter what task you want to be performed and when you want it to be performed. That's a little bit obtuse. They don't really spell that out for you that well, but the syntax for that is you put in the minute, the hour, the day of the month, the day of the week, and then the actual command. So let's say that I wanted to back up my user folder to my backup drive every Friday at 9:42 a.m. which I would never do because that's probably when I use my computer most, but let's just say that's what I want to do. So what I would do is type in 42, which is the 42 minutes,
number of minutes.
Yeah, and then 9, which is 9 o'clock in the morning. So if I wanted to do it at night, which would probably be more realistic, it would be 21, because you use the 24-hour clock. And then the day of the month, which, since I want it to happen every day, or I don't want to specify a certain day of the month, like the 21st. You know, I want this to happen, I guess every week would be how to say it. You just type in an asterisk, because that is the wildcard symbol in Unix. And then you type in, again, since we want this to happen every month, we don't want to specify a certain month, we would type in the asterisk. And then the day of the week, we actually do want to specify. We want it to just happen on Fridays. So I would type in 6, because Sunday is the first day, and then Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, 6. And then you type in the command, which again is rsync space dash av space slash users, my user folder, space volumes, backup volume. And Mac OS X will promptly run that rsync command every Friday at 9:42 religiously. Brilliant. Yeah. And that's how I've been doing my backups lately.
Your .mac account ran out.
I renewed it since then, actually. But I enjoyed the couple of days that I didn't have it, because then I could test, you know, all the different things that I wanted to see what would happen.
And necessity is the mother of invention, right?
Exactly. But you know what? I mean, just to confess here, a couple of days without .mac was torture. I've gotten so reliant on my iDisk, I can't imagine having, and just the synchronization between my Macs. I mean, obviously I think I'm at 6 Macs right now in this apartment. So I mean, it's really nice to have them all kind of be able to talk to each other and synchronize their bookmarks and things like that.
While you were talking about the cron area, I went over to the backup help files, and interestingly enough, there is no mention of whether or not your backup will work, your copy of backup will work if you don't have a .mac subscription.
Right.
I would expect that, and the help file seems to steer you toward the iDisk solution.
Yeah.
Which is fine. I mean, they're archiving and their data vaults are probably a lot more secure than my little USB drive off to one side on my desk.
Right, but I mean, realistically, how many people only have... I mean, they've upped the storage to 10 gigabytes recently, which is great, but even so, how many people have 10 gigabytes of information that they want? Most people I see have 80 gigabytes of music alone.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it's people are a lot of people are pack rats, digitally speaking. But yeah, I mean, the backup. I mean, and the salesperson that was talking to me told me that they really sold it as the backup program. You know, you get that, and then you get to keep it. I'm pretty sure that was explicitly said, and I'm sure he was just misinformed. I don't think he was misleading me by any means. I really think that, the help files just don't make mention of that. I don't think it's something that they publicize, unfortunately. I think that could be a lot clearer.
Well, I'm going to have to just wonder about that, because I'm unwilling to let my .mac subscription lapse.
Probably an okay idea.
We got time for a cool Mac app?
I think so. Do you have one you want to mention? You got anything up your sleeve?
Oh, no. That's much more your department than mine.
Okay, so there's a program that I've been using all the time lately. It's called Adium, A-D-I-U-M.
I've heard of it.
It is a great little program, because obviously, I mean, you and I were talking on the internet way back with ICQ.
Yes.
And I don't know, I mean, that's still around, obviously, but I mean... AOL, the AIM thing kind of popped up because obviously .mac was compatible with AIM, so that kind of gave that a boost. So you've got AIM, you've got .mac, you've got Jabber, which is sort of just the open source generic implementation of that. There's Yahoo Messenger. Of course, Yahoo must have their own Messenger. There's MSN Messenger. Of course, Microsoft has to have their own. And yeah, I'm probably only just skimming the surface. There's so many protocols out there right now for instant messaging that what's a person to do once someone makes friends with people and they're all on different networks.
Use Skype.
Use Skype. Exactly. Okay, well, there you go. The cool app, the cool Mac app of the week is Skype. There's another app out there called Adium, and it literally, it just brings all of those networks together. So you can establish your own, your accounts in Adium. You just enter each one into its little preference pane, and then you're live. You're on all of those networks, all in one buddy list. You've got all of your buddies showing, and everyone can talk to you, and you can talk to them, regardless of what network or what instant message protocol you know you're using. And it's fluid, it's easy, it's completely familiar. It's if you've used any other popular chat environment, and they have a couple of different themes, if I recall correctly. When I first started using it, I think I played around with a couple of different themes. And yeah, there's just no reason not to use it, except that it doesn't have video chat. If you're doing, iChat with video, you're a little bit out of luck there.
Well, then that would make a case for iChat trumping all, but as far as getting all the rest into one room, as it were, Adium is the way to go.
Yeah, it really is. The icon's really odd, but other than that, it's a really cool application.
Okay.
And I don't have the URL on me. I'm going to have to include it in the show notes. But if you Google Adium, you'll find it. It's Adium. It's free. It's cool. Try it out.
Okay, I will.
So, Gort, a friend of mine, actually a couple of friends of mine, came to me. One had sent his Macintosh away to a company it was a laptop, and some company out there actually is upgrading, the CPUs in old PowerBooks to something, more powerful. They sent it back to him, and I guess it was more powerful. They'd upgraded it as advertised, but his Ethernet port had ceased to function, so hardwiring, it was either his wireless card or his hardwire or both. He could not get online to save his life, no matter what he did.
That's really strange. That shouldn't have happened.
Well, he assumed, and it seemed possible that the company he'd sent it off to, had broken his Ethernet port or something like that. But it didn't sound right to me. So the first thing I do anytime that I am having serious network issues. I mean, if I can't connect to the internet, I might check my airport base station, check my airport setting, things like that. But we got past all of that. That was kind of not the problem. So I opened up the terminal and I typed in ifconfig. So ifconfig. And that gives you a list of all of the networking protocols or networking functions available to your computer. So on the Mac, there are a couple. There's LO, which is always your local address. So that's always 127.0.0.1. So that's always your computer. So if you ever want to play around with monitoring, what packets are being sent back and forth in your network, if you set, for instance, your TCP dump or whatever you're monitoring to LO, you'll be monitoring yourself. And that's kind of fun sometimes, just to see what's actually happening when, for instance, you go to a certain website, what's flying through the air. It'll show you everything. But the other options are typically, your wireless connection and your hardwire connection. So it's EN0 and I think EN1. And I believe it's EN0 that's your wireless and EN1 is your hardwire. And so I brought that up, and the system was definitely recognizing that both his hardwire Ethernet port and his airport card were in the system. They showed up as valid connections that could be made. But they weren't reading anything. I think they had their MAC address, but they didn't recognize that they were assigned to any network, and they didn't recognize even that they were really capable of sending packets out. So the trick to really know is, it's really simple. It's ifconfig, and then whatever connection is giving you a problem. So it's either EN0 or EN1, and then down. And that brings that connection down, and it forces the system to kill anything related to that connection. So if config space EN1 space down would bring your Ethernet down.
And render it silent.
Yeah, well, good point. So that if you're in a public place and you don't want your wireless card to be speaking to anyone, you could bring it down really easily that way. But then what you can do is bring it back up. So if config space EN1 space up restarts that connection, basically. And after doing that to both his computer and another person who happened to be having, like, the bizarrely enough, the same exact problem, he hadn't sent his computer away. It was another issue. But, you know, basically, connections weren't working like they should. And no matter what they were doing in their GUI, you know, in the system preferences, they just couldn't seem to get this connection to come up and be recognized. Doing the ifconfig down, waiting a couple of seconds, if config back up, restarted the connection, and bang, they were back online just like that.
I think it's important to note here that the symptoms that you talked about would simply, you know, to a hardware kind of guy like myself, would be, oh, well, got a bad card.
Absolutely, yeah.
Bad Ethernet chip or something, you know, and start with a soldering iron.
Yeah, and that's what he was ready to do. And I think that's what the people he had taken it to were kind of ready to do as well. That he'd gotten the diagnosis from a certified Mac technician that, hey, it's a bad card. And I kind of imagined when I heard that, you know, what they did was what you would do or what I would have done. You know, just you plug in the cable, you look in the system preferences, make sure that it's set properly. It doesn't work, so yeah, it must be bad hardware. But, yeah, it turns out it was just a weird, and I don't know what caused it, you know, I don't know what happened, but I do know that when you're starting up, when you're booting up, you know, the system, especially for the guy who had the upgraded chip, the kernel is supposed to load all the different modules that it detects, and if for whatever reason it's not loading those modules incorrectly, you know, maybe before they replaced that chip, something got hung up, and it just never got restarted. You know, I mean, changing a CPU is a pretty drastic process. So,
oh, yeah.
I'm not even sure how many people really even understand what's happening when you're signing on to a network or the internet. You know, I mean, there's a lot of different terms. There's a lot of different processes going on. You're pretty familiar with all that stuff, actually. Can you give, like, layman's term or layman's definitions maybe for a couple of the big ones like TCP/IP, things like this?
You know, the analogy I like to use here is that not everybody that drives a car is a mechanic.
Right.
And network engineers and stuff, we do what we do, and it's kind of like, yeah, lady, don't worry about it. I put the right pressure in the tires, and I rotated them like the manual says, and I torqued all the bolts down the way they should be, and you're good to go.
Right.
And the same sort of thing happens in the network world. We have these TCP/IP, and make sure your DHCP is set correctly, and don't worry about it.
Yeah.
But just for, you know, familiarization's sake, just to point to a couple of things and say, yeah, that's the carburetor. Those are the spark plug wires and things of that nature. We got probably the most popular thing you hear bantered about is the TCP/IP. Transmission Configuration Protocol / IP, that's the Internet Protocol.
Okay.
Ancient history, they used to be two separate things and controlled separately because of the hardware back in those days, but now it's kind of combined and all taken care of. The Transmission Configuration Protocol and Internet Protocol being part of what we use for our transmission.
Right, that's right. When we're sending, like, information to one computer or onto the internet, that's what we're using.
It's got to do with how it's the digital signal is parsed out, and the timing spaces between the pulses and so forth that define a packet. One that, you know, to oversimplify it, it's a matter of Morse code. Certain bits indicate a bunch of information is coming for so long. Keep listening, and then after that, stop listening and let me know that you got it okay. That dates back to the old teletype communication from which that's derived, the TCP part.
Okay.
Your IP is your internet protocol, and it has to do with addressing. That could be likened to a telephone number. A certain sequence of numbers, separated in this case by periods or dots, and that makes up your IP address. People are quite familiar with that now, at least the ones that dig around a little bit and maybe look at the headers on their email, and they'll oftentimes see a 192.168.2.1 and then some sort of indication behind that as to what the server name might be. And that's your IP address. It used to be that these IP addresses were handed out individually, just the same way phone numbers were. I worked in a small county in Maryland for a while, setting up networks, and the county was so small.
How small was it?
It had three large servers, and that was the whole internet connection for the county. It was all dial-up.
Wow.
Dial-up was easy because you dial into it and you get a connection, but if somebody wanted a regular connection all the time because they were running some sort of business and they expected input or connections from outside the county, they had to have their own IP address, and they were assigned a given IP address.
So that's a static IP address.
Static IP. The original internet was set up that way because there are only 25 or so computers around the whole country that were going to talk to each other, so they all had numbers or IP addresses that were similar to 75.195.25.1. And then another one on campus might be those same set of numbers, .2. And so forth. And so that's how those numbers are set up. That's your IP address. Now, those there's a finite number of those. There's a whole lot of them, but there's still only just so many. And it comes to the point where, well, if you're not going to have your computer all the time, why can't I borrow your address? And in fact, that is managed by a protocol known as the Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol. That is a method where a host computer, that's the dynamic host part, the host configuration, keeps track of who is using what IP address at what time, and when it's no longer being used, allows that IP address to be reassigned to another user, and that's your DHCP.
Wow. And so is it completely just beyond the laws of possibility that you could still run out of IP addresses in a certain area, or?
Oh, actually, that's a great concern, and that's why we're going from Internet Protocol version 4 to Internet Protocol version 6. The IP address will no longer simply be four big numbers separated by four periods, three periods. It'll be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 sets of hexadecimal numbers.
Wow.
Separated by seven colons.
Wow.
Yeah. So your IP version 4 was four sets of numbers, which could conceivably be as high as 255.255.255.255. And it'd take me a lot longer to say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 sets of four hexadecimal numbers.
Yeah.
For IP version 6.
Wow.
And like I say, I haven't done the math on that, but it's a whole lot more numbers.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's got to be, that would be a lot. I'm sure everyone could have their own IP address, no problem then.
Well, it approaches that, but we'll still use DHCP to ensure that we don't run out of numbers. Because what that means is, so I've got a cable modem, and the internet service provider, the ISP, the big server at the ISP, finds our cable modem or our DSL modem, whatever kind of modem we have, and says, okay, I'm going to give you an IP number. And then from that IP number, our airport or our wireless connection takes that and uses just the one number. And even that one is DHCP, but we don't have to worry about it. That's what the ISP takes care of.
Right.
Our airport or wireless connection takes that and and holds it and says, okay, I'm going to use that one IP, but I'm going to appear to the cable company as a single computer, and then I'm going to reapportion that one IP address down to as many, up to 255 within my own house or an internal network.
Right.
And that's also done with DHCP, and typically those numbers start with 10, just for an ease of use. You can assign it anything you want because it's invisible to the cable company.
I see.
So that's how DHCP is used to the advantage of both the cable company, the ISP, and to the user to make sure that we can all stay connected.
Wow, that is very cool.
So let's see. We got the TCP/IP. We got DHCP. The other one probably that we hear about is DNS. And that's your domain name services. Also a domain name server. Typically, that's your static IP, your one address, and that's a main server that takes care of an entire network. Does that cover enough, you think, for pointing out the parts of what makes it go?
I think so. I think that's a really good explanation.
We covered firewall.
We did cover firewalls.
A popular one is a ping.
Yes.
Hey, ping me. What does ping mean? Well, we come to know that ping means send me a signal or send me something, send me a test message or something. Ping is actually the packet internet grouper is what it actually stands for.
I had no idea that was an abbreviation for something.
Yeah, it's kind of a convoluted one because it's...
Right,
it's
they're cheating.
It's a P, an IN, yeah. And then a GF cheat. But it's ping. It's a packet internet grouper. It's a set of test packets sent out and immediately listening for a return from a target.
So the idea is that when one sends, for instance, a picture via email or even just an email message, they're not sending they're not sending the entire thing. They're streaming information to the server for over a duration of time in smaller bite-sized packets.
True enough.
And then the server reassembles those packets and sends it back to the next place.
It would be, yes, it would be much the same way. If we did it conversationally, I'd say, now I'm going to tell you about the keyboard. Did you get that? And you'd say, yeah, you're going to tell me about the keyboard. And then I say, right, keyboard. Okay, now I'm going to tell you about the return button. You get that? And he says, well, yeah, you're going to tell me about the keyboard and the return button.
I got you.
Okay. And it goes back and forth like that very, very quickly.
Wow.
In a matter of milliseconds.
Right. And basically, I mean, even a Skype call such as this one is doing that just phenomenally fast then.
Oh, yeah. And if you wanted to know how fast, you'd call up the technical info window and you can sit down there and watch the sent packets, received packets. And actually, they don't do send and receive. They do packet losses because it's a given that there are going to be some transmission losses along the way.
Right, especially on something that's happening in real time and is as demanding as, like, voice, replicating a voice, I guess.
Correct. But amazingly so, here's a round-trip packet information. A round-trip is 160 milliseconds.
Wow.
And what our listeners probably don't know is that I'm on the East Coast and you're on the West Coast.
Correct, yes. Pretty fantastic. Well, that was very enlightening in that case, Gort. Thanks for the dissection of the internet. And you know what? I think we're out for the episode. I think that I think we covered everything that people need to know about backing up and about making sure that they're online all the time.
Excellent.
In that case, let's get people to email us. This has been the Bad Apples, episode 06. And if you need to email us, it's Gort, G-O-R-T, .klaatu, K-L-A-A-T-U, @gmail.com. That is Gort.klaatu @gmail.com. You can always visit the website. We have free desktop art for you to download. We've got all the back episodes for you to listen to in case you just joined us recently or you just want to listen to an old one for reference. Website is thebadapples.info. You can also find us at thebadapples.5gbfree.com. Either way works. And the music for all the Bad Apple episodes was provided by the mysterious band Fat Chance Lester. And This has been The Bad Apples, episode 06. Come back next time for more Mac apps, Mac hacks, and Mac tips.
And yet there still is hope for him, for out of the day's events, a dim awareness growing in him, a vague realization that perhaps the road he's on isn't quite the one he wants to travel.